Hey everybody, my name is Don. I'm a compulsive eater and food addict. You paid to come here? Wow. Well, as Maria, I hope I live up to that. I did go through the steps with Maria. And of course, the last part of that was, you will now take somebody else through the steps, right? That's what the 12th step is all about, passing it on, passing it on, passing it on. So, you know, service is gratitude in action. If you really have the gratitude, you'll give it away. You'll pass it on. So you've now heard the 12th step, so we can just do the other 11. So tonight, I want to tell you a little about a bit about me. The schedule says speakers or the leader's story. So I'm going to do that, but it's going to be within the framework of the steps, of course, because the steps are everything. The steps save my life. Continue to save my life. They gave me a life. I came to the program January 26, 1982. So it's 29 and a half years ago. Coming up on 30 pretty soon. So, and my wife celebrates tomorrow 25 years in the program. We met in the program. We met in an OA meeting in Paris, France in 1986. So a great story. But has nothing to do with this weekend. Other than the reason that's on my mind about her anniversary is that I forgot it. It was on my calendar. I thought about it 2 days ago. I wrote down, get a card, da-da-da. And then I got thinking about this and one thing and another, and here I am, and I forgot it. So phone call tomorrow, I guess. That'll have to do it. So we're going to talk about my story tonight within the framework of the steps, and we'll talk a little bit about what you're going to do, what we're going to do for the rest of the weekend. There's going to be breakout groups, and I'll talk more about that later. The breakout groups does mean that we will have to go to some of the other facilities. And it's very, very important, and I'm going to hammer this over and over and over and over, to come back on time. So if it's a 45-minute breakout and we're going to resume at X o'clock, please be back. So give yourself time to take the 5-minute walk, go to the restroom, whatever, when you're coming back over from your cottage. Yes?
Will some of them be in this building?
Yes. There'll be one here and then in two other buildings. So, but we'll cover all that in the morning. And take numbers, right? It's going to be a 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And the ones will go together. The twos will go together. And you'll stay together, right, for the weekend.
Some people may have to stay here because
Yes. That's fine. We'll make whatever adaptations. If there's mobility problems or any other kind of thing, we'll do that as we go. So, a couple of days ago, I sat down in front of the computer and I said, I was starting to think about this and asking myself, what is it that I really have to give? Because, you know, I'm not here as a teacher. I'm here as a guy that's been around a long time, a guy that the program worked for and continues to work for. And so what I've got to share is my almost 30 years of experience. And that's really what I'm here to share about. So I'm not here to teach you how to do this. Everybody has to do it. The slogan says, take what you want and leave the rest. But I'm always very quick to say, but if what you're taking isn't working, you better think about what it is, right? So we're going to talk a lot about action this weekend. Action, 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 action. This is not an osmosis program. It's an action program. Everything is action from the first step on. From the setting up of a plan of eating, everything is action, action, action. I don't think my way into recovery. I act my way into right recovery. Into recovery. It just doesn't work by thinking, right? I don't become a parent by going to PTA meetings, right? And in the same way, I can't just get well here by going to meetings. I have to do something. I have to take action. So I sat down and I said, now what do I have to give? What can I give from my own experience and from my particular abilities that would be the most helpful? And I'm going to tell you what I wrote down on the list for what it's worth. And then at the end of this thing at 12 o'clock, we'll see how many of these things came to pass, right? I said, one, I want to implant the phrase, trust the process permanently in their brains. Trust the process. You don't have to understand the 12-step process. Just do it. Hmm. I didn't have to understand addiction in the beginning of my program. I just had to act as if. So I will say over and over, you'll hear me say it over and over this weekend, trust the process. Trust the process. We got 75 years of experience in AA, 50 years of experience in OA. How many years do you need to be convinced that it works if you work it, as we say at the end of the meetings, right? So it does work. So trust it, trust it. Just keep going. Do what the step says and keep moving into the next step. You know, it's not a 3-step program. It's a 12-step program. Lots of people stop after the 3rd step and get hung up on that 4th step. That was one thing. So trust the process. Another thing I said was my 3-column approach to defining a plan of eating. We probably are not going to do that. I'm going to focus on the steps instead of a plan of eating. I'm going to assume that most of you are abstinent or close to abstinent or have been abstinent, or I'm just going to assume that rather than spending 15 minutes of our time working on a plan of eating, unless somebody tells me differently after the meeting tonight, and then we'll spend some time on that in the morning. Understanding the nature of the disease and addiction. Simplifying the steps. I really like simplifying. I had a really good first sponsor who said, keep it simple, keep it simple, keep it simple. He told me my problem was that I was educated beyond my intelligence. And at first I thought that was a compliment. Turns out that's not what he meant. Keep it simple, keep it simple. So I like to try to simplify the steps because they're not really complicated. But of course they're written in old-fashioned words. And sometimes we get hung up on those words. And then we get hung up on that terrible G-O-D word, you know, because that strikes terror into so many of us. So maybe I can simplify a lot of that. 6, understand the process of transformation. That's what the steps are. They are a change process as old as mankind. As old as mankind. Back in the corporate world a long time ago in another life, I was a change agent. I worked on change. So I know a little bit about change. And so it was really remarkable that it took me so many years to happen across the 12-step process, which was a change process. There it was. It changed me, transformed me. 7, understanding spiritual awakening. What is that all about? 8, understanding the collective power of the 12, 12, and 9. 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 9 tools, not 8 tools. I'm only getting used to saying 9 now. I've been saying 8 for a very, very long time. Understanding the collective power of the 12, 12, 9, and the slogans in the fellowship. 9, understanding co-creation, as I understand co-creation. The fact that we have the power to make choices and take actions. I say that God won't do for us what we need to do for ourselves. It's my particular philosophy. You're going to hear a lot about that, particularly in steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. 10, our part in steps 6 and 7, practicing the new thinking and new behavior until it becomes habitual. 11, taking responsibility, no more victim. I am an expert in self-pity. I know more about self-pity than anybody else because I spent so many years in self-pity. And that was one of the first things that I had to really get whacked in the head about when I came into the program. Get off the pity pot. I had a really hard, tough love sponsor who said to me over and over and over, get off of the pity pot, you know, quit feeling sorry for yourself. It's up to you. It's your responsibility, etc. And I'll talk more about that over the weekend. So what I've come to find out is martyrdom is stupid. Martyrdom. 12, understanding nothing happens without action, action, action. As I've already said, we act away into right thinking, not think our way into right acting. Decisions are useless unless followed by action. We decide to do something in the 3rd step, it means absolutely nothing if you don't follow it up by action. Decisions, unless followed by action, are pure delusions. Nothing happens unless you do something about it. If we have any teachers here, you are familiar with the slogan, no drill, no skill. 13, understanding that recovery is not permanent. We must continue to do what brought us recovery in the first place. 10, 11, and 12. And all the rest of the steps. Nothing is permanent. This disease, if you've got the disease, I don't know if you all have the disease. Because you're here doesn't mean you necessarily have the disease. You have to accept that. A lot of people pretend to have the disease and comply and say all the words, but don't really truly accept it. Right in here. And those are the people that relapse. Those are the people that are in and out and in and out and in and out of the rooms, because someplace deep inside they really don't fully accept that genetically there's something different, that biochemically there's something different in them. That's the disease. We'll talk more about that tomorrow in the first step. Showing what I do to keep the obsession lifted. And that's obviously that'll take place as we go through the steps. What is it that I do to keep the obsession lifted? So with that, that's kind of the overall picture of what I hope to be able to do here this weekend. So let me tell you a little bit about myself. I've already said I came to the program in 1982, January 26, 1982. And how did I get here? Well, a little bit about the early childhood. There's a little paragraph I like to read to give you some background on that early childhood, because I could spend the rest of the night there, and then you would get this wonderful understanding of how I got to be who I was. But who cares? It really doesn't make any difference how I got here. What makes a difference is what I do now. Insight is useless unless followed by action. I could have all the insight into my terrible childhood and blah, 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 but it means nothing unless I do something about it. So I'm only interested not in all of the analysis. I'm interested in, okay, what is it that I need to do to arrest the addiction, to arrest the obsession, to arrest the compulsive eating? And I call myself a compulsive eater and an addict. What do I have to do to arrest that and keep it arrested? And that has to do with certain ways of living that the program talks about. The program is a design for living. It's a philosophy. It's a way of believing. It's a way of acting. And it works. I was, I think I put it away, but I was looking at something, a biography of Bill. And may have been in his obituary in 71. But it was talking about he discovered through a lot of pain and over a long time a process of actions and ways of living that allowed him to stay from picking up the first drink. So he stayed abstinent from the alcohol by doing these things, and that's what he wrote down in the Big Book. Of course, the Big Book was the first. He would have been the first to tell you that the Big Book was very early, you know. The Big Book was very, very early in this whole thing. And there were a lot of holes in the Big Book, and that's why he wrote the 12 and 12. He said, you know, I was a spiritual nincompoop when I wrote the Big Book. Had some help, but it was mostly him. So he wrote the 12 and 12, and by that time he had 15 years more experience in the program. So the 12 and 12, AA 12 and 12, was a valuable book. So anyway, some of my childhood stuff. Fear, doubt, and insecurity dominated my life as a small child, as early as I can remember. I always felt out of step, different, separate, distrustful, afraid. The world was basically a hostile and unfriendly place where I had to do a lot of pretending and play acting in order to get along. At age 41, when I came to the program, I was still that same frightened, insecure, pretending little kid, only more so. A lot of years of pretense and fear and insecurity had passed. The result, when I came, was self-hatred, a feeling of uselessness, adrift, trapped, and victim. Victim, 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 blaming, 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 poor me, poor me, pour me a drink. Except alcohol was not my biggest problem. Alcohol was like sugar for me. It was just something I did. So, but alcohol never took me to the depths that the food did. So, but alcohol was one of the first things I had to come off of. And I did not have as much of a problem with alcohol as I did with some of the food. So that's the way I felt. Victim, trapped, all of that despite being a pretty high-functioning person on the outside. I mostly followed the "this is what you're supposed to do" script. This is what you're supposed to do. That was the script that I followed, even though it never really aligned with my inner self. So this inside-outside disparity continued until I began to bring the two together through the transformation process of the steps. What I found in the steps was that steps 1 to 3 prepared to get me well, steps 4 to 9 got me well, and steps 10, 11, and 12 keep me well. So I want to pass out to you little bookmarks that I made yesterday with the steps, just the simple steps on them, and you'll see they're grouped. And the reason I'm giving you these is because I'm going to talk about the steps all the time, be jumping around, and I've put them up here on the wall. But here's a little convenient thing if you want to look at the step or whatever. So I'll just pass those around.
Don, can you repeat what you just said?
I have no idea what I just said.
I mean, the, you know, 1 through 3 did what? 4 through 9?
Oh, 1, 2, and 3 prepare me to get well. 4 through 9 get me well. And 10, 11, and 12 keep me well. So for me, OA has been and was a rebuilding my life program. It was not a diet program. It was a rebuilding my life program. So that's a little bit of introduction on there. Who am I? Where was I from? How did I get to the program? I come from West Virginia, mountains of West Virginia, coal mining town. As a little kid, my earliest memories are being on my front porch watching these guys go to work with their lunch pails, and they were white in the morning, and I would see them coming back at night, and they were black. This is old coal mining, dog hole mining in those days. You know, none of the big technology. These guys were in there on their hands and knees with their picks, digging out bucket by bucket by bucket. And that's the area where I came from. It's still there. Many of the coal mines are closed now. The ones that are not closed are now high technology, right? So unemployment is 30-40% down there. So that's where I come from, mountains of Appalachia. You're going to hear, unfortunately, a lot about my mother this weekend. Yes, she's been a problem for me since I was born. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute. She is mentally challenged, sixth grade education, comes from a alcohol abusive family. Her father was a gutter level drunk back in the mountains. I mean, she really lived in the mountains. She lived up a holla, right, as we call them then. One of 8 kids. She ran away from home at age 13. To escape her abusing father. She'd had him arrested 3 times, and the last time that she had him arrested, he came back the next day. He got out of this little one-room jail they had, and he came and picked her up by the throat, put a straight razor to her throat, and said, "That's it. The next time, you are dead." And she left sixth grade, never went back. She ran away. She went to the big city. Big city in those days was, you know, not what we would call a big city today, but it was a city where there were glass factories. She lied about her age, went to work in a glass factory, and met my father a few years later in their teens and married, and I'm the result. So she was abused in all ways, and is it any doubt that she would be full of doubt and fear and insecurity? She is the most fearful person I've ever met. And she taught me a lot of stuff, and much of it was totally wrong because of her stuff. My first sponsor, in his unique way with words, used to say, "Don, you know, shit runs downhill." And it's true. Stuff goes from generation to generation until there's some kind of an intervention, until it's sometime broken. And you see it in addiction all the time, and alcoholism, generation to generation. Well, she did a lot of stuff. And And you'll hear about some of those ideas that she put into me. So that was, she was a fundamentalist, and that's also a big part of my story. Born again fundamentalist, forced me into that as a small child. And what I saw back in those mountains as a small child, I'm talking 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, was just what I would call today just craziness. I saw speaking in tongues. I saw the snakes used in the worship. I saw people just go hysterical. I saw hymn books being bounced off the ceilings of the church and hitting people in the head. I was forced to the altar at about 6 and saved, whatever that meant. Then I was baptized in the river, etc., etc., etc. And so I was convinced by the time that I was, 7, 8 years old, that I was doomed, that I was going to hell, that there was nothing I could do, because all I heard was, you think bad thoughts, you're going to hell. You don't have to do them, just think them. And that's what I heard as a little kid. That's the way I heard it anyway. And so that really messed me up. I walked away from that when I was finally old enough to do that and say, no more, I won't go anymore. But I was about 12 years old by that time. So I had been really, really, really just drowned in this. Now, if you ask her about this, she would say it's the most wonderful thing she ever did for me. Right? But it didn't come out that way. So, childhood, somebody once asked me in a seminar someplace, what was it you most needed to hear but didn't in your childhood? What was it you most needed to hear but didn't? And the question resonated with me, and I remember where I was, and I remember writing down 5 things, just bang, 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 just in like 5 seconds, 10 seconds, just came out of the pen. And this is what they were. Most needed to hear but didn't. It's okay to make mistakes. Just try it. No, it was not okay to make mistakes. My mother has a COD, perfectionist, cleaner, perfection. I used to have to go home, walk home from school in grade school so that she could wash me and change my clothes. Right, so because my morning clothes would be wrinkled. Okay, so another thing, it doesn't make any difference what they think. It did make a difference. That's what I learned as a child as to how to govern my behavior. What would they think? Right, that's all that mattered. What would they think? So everything I did was based upon what would you think of me if I did that in my head. What would you think? What would I think that you think of me? Right. And so you can see where that goes. You know, that goes to eventually to a life of always play acting, always being a phony, never being authentic. Big difference between the outside and the inside. Remember, I mentioned outside and inside before. Big difference in that. Third thing was there's nothing to fear. She was the most fearful person that I have ever still today. I'm 70 years old, and I have never met anyone as fearful as she is. And it's gotten worse. She's 91 years old, and I am solely responsible for her. I'm an only child. That's another part of the story that you'll hear later. Another one I didn't hear, number 4, was you are okay. For some reason, I never felt like it was okay. I always felt like I was inadequate, inferior, less than. And I really never heard, and she would dispute this one, I'm sure, but I don't remember hearing from my father or my mother as a child the words, I love you. I don't remember. Yes. We're going to find out as I talk about myself here that many of you are probably my sisters. Not everybody, but we share so many things. This is how we get here. You know? There may be somebody in this room that had a really, totally, 100% normal childhood. But I'd like to see you after the meeting. No, it's true. There are. This disease doesn't always start, right? This disease can start anytime. So that gives you some idea of the childhood. Let me move on now. At age 19 in college, it was a life-altering experience for me. I I went with a girl, my first love, all through high school, sophomore, junior, senior year. And as far as I'm concerned, I was in love, and I thought she was in love. And my dream was that we would go to college, go off together to college, and do our thing in college, graduate, get married, live happily ever after. So we went off to college together. Then a funny thing happened. She met up with older men. And I started hearing things like, you know, you really need to grow up. And the incident that broke my back and really affected my life for 20 years, was a night at the fraternity party, second semester there. I was at a fraternity party, and I wasn't a member of the fraternity party. I guess I was there for, pledging or whatever it was, but I was there and drinking, of course. And I remember suddenly hearing three or four guys, like where that chair is, talking. And as college age guys are wont to do, they were talking about their exploits and their conquest. And I listened a little bit, and they were saying, well, we did this, blah, 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 blah. And I began realizing that who they were talking about was my girl, this young woman. I was 19, that I was deeply in love with. And I left there, and I remember going to the roof of the gym and raising my fist to the sky, to a God that I didn't believe in, but God, and saying, never again, never again, never again am I going to allow myself to be hurt. Never again am I going to allow myself to have somebody come into my heart. I don't need anybody. I don't need anybody at all. I can do this myself. I am self-sufficient. I can be self-sufficient. I'll just get my education. I'll do whatever. But I don't need anybody. I'm not going to let anybody in. So what happened right there was, and it's hindsight, of course, is that I began to build a wall around me, a wall of no feeling. Guess who in my family had no feelings? My father was a stone. I became my father. Didn't realize it was happening, but the wall got thicker and thicker and thicker. And, of course, nobody could get in, but, of course, I couldn't get out. Thus began about a 20-year binge of self-sufficiency. I did a lot of stuff, but it was all self-sufficient stuff, and it was all in a crazy, chaotic way. I went in the military. I was in the military for several years. Finished college. Went back to graduate school. Did a lot of stuff. Got a job in a dream job in a dream corporation. At that time, the most profitable corporation on the earth. Great job. But never was happy. Got married, had kids, but that wall was there. Married. My wife, it was a basic, by the way, I got married 6 months after this incident that I'm telling you about. So need I say more about that? It was basically a rebound. And it was wrong. I knew it within a short time. But where I come from, you don't get divorces. You don't do any of that kind of stuff. I once said to my father after several years in the marriage, you know, this just is the wrong. It's been wrong from the beginning. we really should get a divorce. And he said, what? No, we don't do that in this family. We don't do things like that. He said, look at your mother and I. We've hated each other for years. And we don't get divorced. So he said, you made your bed, now you sleep in it. You packed your pipe, now that's the way it is. So I stayed in a marriage that was no good for 26 years. 26 years, long time. So that was part of my problem that eventually led me to OA. So while I was in that marriage and I was doing all this other stuff, though, I had, as I said, big corporate jobs, progressed very, very rapidly in a corporation. Why wouldn't I? I was a perfectionist. I was so full of fear. Of course, perfectionism is one of the stepchildren of fear, right? Fear has several stepchildren: controlling, perfectionism, procrastination, anxiety. But perfectionism is one of them. So I was always so perfect because I was so afraid of criticism, right, that I worked harder than anybody else. So I kept getting promoted and promoted and promoted and promoted. So I reached close to the top. Was making a lot of money, living in the right places in Westchester County, New York, you know, the right house in the right area, the right cars in the garage, two daughters in the right finishing schools up in Connecticut. And all I wanted to do was kill myself. So the eating started. I was not a obese child. I was always a little overweight child. I was in those days they called them the chubby section, or the husky section. Husky. The husky. Girls were chubby, boys were in the huskies, right? So I always wore huskies. But in high school I was a big jock. I lettered in four different sports in high school. So I burned. I ate a lot, but I burned the calories off. And then, of course, that all stopped. And then some of the other life stuff that I'm talking about started in college. And I began to seriously eat in my late teens. And, you know, as I look back, it's very clear that I was using food as a drug. I didn't realize that. All I knew was food felt kind of good. Food took the edge off. Some people have defined compulsive overeating as a desperate, irrational attempt to control the uncontrollable. And that's really what was going on. I was taking the edge off, and then, of course, I would need more to take the edge off. So it was very much emotional eating. Emotional eating. And it just got worse. And so in my 20s, it started to go up. I needed more and more. You know, the two or three donuts became the half dozen donuts. The half a pizza became a whole pizza. And ultimately, I went up. I remember the first time I hit 300 pounds. Then I said, that's it. And I went on a diet and lost weight. And then for about 10 years, it became the stair step. You know, lose 50, gain 60. Lose 75, gain 125. Lose 125, gain 150, until went over 400 pounds. And that's about when I came to OA, somewhere around 400 pounds. When I came to OA in January of 1982, I was suicidal. Christmas night, 1981. I had left the house in the middle of the night, unknown to the family, driven to the bridge over the Hudson River in New York area, upstate New York, written the note, left my wallet, keys, everything in the car. I remember it was a 1971 Volvo, blue, left everything at the edge of the bridge, no one around. Everything at the edge of the bridge, walked to the middle of the bridge, climbed up onto the railing, and there was another second railing, so I climbed up to the second tier. And it's now about 3 o'clock in the morning, Christmas night, 1981, and I'm standing there and looking down, and it's snowing, it's cold, and it's black. All I can see is a tiny dot of light from a tugboat coming down the Hudson River. And I don't know exactly how long I stood there. But obviously I did not do it. Obviously something brought me down. So I came down and reversed the whole process, went home. 30 days later, I went into my first OA meeting. Had no clue what it was about. So that was the that's where I was emotionally. Physically, as I've said, it was up over 400 pounds or so. Spiritually, I was an atheist, hardcore, bitter, angry atheist. I've told you something of the childhood. I really, really rebelled against that when I possibly could, as early as I could. And I just hated anything. I was, as far as I was concerned, religion was the cause of all evil. Forever and ever and ever, from my point of view, religion was responsible for the worst mayhem, the rape, the pillage, the everything, everything. Every battle in the world from the earliest days was all about my God versus your God. My God says do this, your God says this, and we go together. Has anything changed? Maybe not. But that's what I thought. So I was brutal and angry and not just a laid-back atheist, but you say the word God and I wanted to attack you. So that's where I was physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Suicidal, grossly obese, and an atheist. Other than that, I had everything going for me. Walked into the first meeting. It was in a rehab. My company saw I was in deep trouble. And I remember my wife, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning one night, I wasn't sleeping. I was walking the floor. And she said something to me. She said, you know, I heard about this place. And she said, and so-and-so told me that they treat the head there and not just the body, and you certainly need that. It was not a compliment, but it stuck in my head. And the next day, I made an inquiry, and I called. 3 days later, I was there. I was in the rehab. I went to my company, and they knew I was in trouble, and they said, go. Yeah. Medical leave, paid medical leave of absence for 3 months. 3 months. So I really got a break. So I walked into my first meeting, January 26th, 1982, in the Downtowner Motor Inn in Durham, North Carolina, in room 101. 10 women and me. Nothing has changed. 10 women and me. And I, of course, was insane. You know, I was eating. I remember it's a 13-hour drive from my home to this place in Durham, North Carolina. I must have stopped at least 10 McDonald's. Seriously. Every McDonald's I saw, I would stop and buy something. I figured, well, going to this place, you know, I might as well get ready. So I ate all the way. So I was in total chaos. I was just drunk. You know, food makes me drunk. I'm a compulsive eater. It makes me drunk. It causes crazy things to my body. We'll talk about that more again in the morning. So there I was in a meeting, and I listened to these people. Now, this was in rehab, right? So all these people were in the rehab. But there was no staff person there leading the meeting. It was, you know, it was the inmates leading the meeting. And I listened to these women, and I listened, and they talked, and they talked about this, and they kept talking about abstinence, and blah, 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 blah. And I didn't know what they were talking about. So an hour later, the meeting was over. And I remember very distinctly picking out the oldest woman in the room. I was 41. So I picked out the oldest woman in the room, who probably was maybe 60. And I went up to her and I said, look, this is all very interesting, but I don't understand it. I said, you guys have been talking about abstinence. What the hell has sex got to do with being overweight? True story. And you know what she said? She said, keep coming back. True story. Absolutely true story. So that's where I started. That's where I started. 2 days later, they put this book in my hand. This is the original book. Okay? It's been rebound twice. I can't let go of it. Saved my life. Put this book in my hand and said, here are all the answers. They also put this book in my hand, which is the 12 and 12. But they said, first read this book. You know, you want to find out what's going on. Study this book. It has all the answers. It will tell you how to get well. And I didn't know I was sick. I didn't know what they were talking about. But I said, okay. So being who I was, I read the book. Right? I fancied myself intellectual. You know what an intellectual is? That's a person whose brain watches itself. So, right? It was also a neurotic. You know what a neurotic is? A self-employed person who can't stand the boss. So, you're going to hear a lot of really bad humor this weekend. So, it's part of the program. So, I studied the big book. I read it through within, I don't know, 2 or 3 days. And I went back to the director and said, okay, I get it. I get it. I get the point of all this. I think I can do this. I said, but I'm going to tell you one thing, though. His name was Richard. There's two guys that saved my life. One is named Richard, and the other one is named Charlie. I'll tell you more about Richard in a second. Richard, I said to Richard, Richard, this is a very interesting book, but it's really, really outdated. My God, it's so old. It's sexist. The language is just terrible. It's some country bumpkin lawyer trying to write highfalutin ways. Has these crazy ideas about never repeating a word, using all these synonyms. My God, it's too hard to understand. This book really needs to be revised. I think it needs to be rewritten. You know, I think maybe I'm just the guy to do it. And that was the first time I heard the expression, shut up. Take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. And you've all heard that. But that was the first time I had heard it. And I was offended. But he meant it. And he said, just follow directions. And I also heard the phrase for the very first time. This is almost 30 years ago now. Trust the process. You don't have to understand that book. You don't really understand that book. Just follow the directions. And so that's what I started doing. I started following the directions. I was a grazer, by the way. And so, in these, as opposed to a big-time binger. And so I'd never heard of binging. So in these meetings, I heard people talking about binges. So I thought, that sounds like something I ought to try. Just in case you thought I was really going to get well immediately. And so I remember, it was about 3 weeks in. They put me on this 800-calorie diet. And 3 meals a day, 800 calorie. And maybe it was 850. No, it was 800. 800. And no sugar and so forth. Basically, gray sheet, except much, much stricter. Much worse than gray sheet. And after about 3 weeks, I was, by the way, I was losing 4 pounds a day. When you weigh that much weight, and you suddenly go from 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 calories a day down to 800, you know, you spend a lot of time in the bathroom. You know, and that's just the way it was. So I was losing all this weight, but nothing was happening in my head. And even though they were working on the powerless stuff with me. And I'm going to speed up now and get into the steps. But after about, I don't know, 3 weeks, as I said, I decided to try the binge thing. So I remember going out and working my way down the street. Started with, I don't know, what was probably Italian place, and then the ice cream place, and then what was, and then it was the pizza place, and then it was something else. But I think I hit 5 places in about 3 hours. And boy, did I get sick. And so I decided maybe grazing was better than binging. And so I just, but that was just one of my early experiments. But I did, you know, I did start losing weight. And they did thrust me into the big book very quickly. And we started talking about the first step. And remember, I was a self-made man, educated beyond my intelligence, successful businessman, plenty of money. Well, not rich, but, you know, enough money, comfortable. And felt pretty proud of myself, right? Pretty proud of my egomaniac with inferiority complex, as they say. Or said another way, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. And they started throwing around this word, powerless. I said, no way. What are you talking about, powerless? This is one of the problems with the vocabulary in the steps. So I said, no, I'm not powerless. And Charlie came on the scene now. Charlie was 16 years sober in AA. And he came on the scene. He, like so many, had changed chairs on the Titanic. He was 16 years sober, but he had picked up the food. And now he couldn't stop eating. You know, the rooms are full. Probably some of you in this room, I'm sure there's some of you in this room who came from that program, did the same thing. So here was Charlie. Charlie knew everything there was to know about the big book. And so he really, really helped me on the big book, and he became my sponsor. And he was that hard-ass sponsor that I was talking about before. He didn't take any crap at all. So I began working with him, and he had a way with words. And he was what I needed. You know, me, the big intellectual. Charlie could barely put an entire sentence together with the subject and the predicate and the verbs and the whatever's in the right order. But he could say what he needed to say. So he was just what I needed, right? Remember the six steps of the Oxford program. The first one is ego deflation, complete deflation, you know. So Charlie was what I needed to break that ego in me. I needed this guy, this semi-illiterate guy, telling me stuff that I needed to hear. And so he did do that. Powerless, he said, let me ask you a question. Are you overweight? Yeah. Why? Why what? Why are you overweight? I guess I eat too much. Really? Do you, is that what you want to do? You want to eat too much? Well, no. You want to be overweight? Well, no. Then why don't you eat less then? Oh, well, I have stopped. Time after time I've stopped. That's just, I cannot stop starting again. And he said, well, tell me again now. If you want to eat less, but can't, why is that? Yeah, I really want to. But you can't? No. You mean you don't have the willpower to do that? You, your big tough guy, doesn't have the willpower to put down the damn fork? Really? And of course, you know, he backed me into that corner. And what could I say? Is that what powerless means? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what powerless means. I have a disease over which willpower is useless. That's the way I say the first step. I have a disease over which willpower is useless. My willpower couldn't do it. But I don't know why. I just had so much trouble with that word, powerless, 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 powerless. It was an ego thing, obviously, and false pride. So then so I got through that, stayed abstinent, and began working the rest of the steps. Again, remember, I was still suicidal. The suicidal stuff didn't go away for quite a while. One of the crazy things that was in my mind, I remember when I went there to this rehab, was, you know, maybe if I just would lose a little weight, I'd get up enough nerve to go back to the bridge and do it. Of course it's insane, but I was insane. So I began working on the second step, came to believe that maybe something could help me. And of course that was nothing more than the people in the rooms. I didn't want any of the God stuff, but I saw some people around. I heard people telling stories, and my God, they came from some really, really bad places. And they weren't there anymore, and they were laughing about it. So what's the deal here? So what they did was give me hope, and that's all the second step was. I buzzed right through the second step without having to deal with any of that higher power stuff. It was all about hope. Third step, whoa, what is this stuff? What does this mean? And I began reading the big book and the 12 and 12, and thanks to Charlie and others, I was able to see that the third step was just a decision to work the program. That's really all it was. That's all it was. All I was doing was turning over one set of ideas for another set of ideas. The new set of ideas is the steps, traditions, slogans, tools. That's power. It's where the power comes from those things. So that's really what I was doing. Made a decision to turn my thinking and my behaving over to this step process. Trust the process. Trust the process. You don't have to understand it. Don't worry about all the God stuff. God can be whatever you want. Now, in hindsight, I see I was making that stuff as a higher power. That's the glorious thing about this 12-step process. You know, whatever your higher power is, whatever works. People get too hung up sometimes on the God thing. Whatever works for you. So I got through that by simply saying, okay, I'll do it, which got me into the fourth step, which is where the action was. Causes and conditions. Now we get down to causes and conditions, the big book says. And there's where I began to see that what my problems were, that I've met the enemy and it is me, and that, in fact, I fixed most of my problems by changing myself, not others. And that was a terrible, terrible thing to say. Terrible, terrible thing to realize that I am responsible for myself. But it just showed, you know, it's never too late to grow up and take responsibility. Because that's really what happened to me in this transformation process of the steps. I began to grow up and take responsibility. So I began looking at myself, and I began to start thinking in the context of toxic food, toxic thinking, and toxic behavior. My toxic foods were really clear to me. You know, the whole general sugar and refined carbs, those were clearly my alcohol. We'll talk much more about this in the morning. We talk about addiction. But they were clearly my alcohol, where I just couldn't have one, where they set up a craving in me. And so it was very clear what my toxic foods were. But now I identified in my toxic foods in the first step, and now I have to identify my toxic thinking. Because my thinking is just as bad as the food, because it's this toxic thinking that leads me back to the drug of food. So I have to identify what needs change. Remember we said 1, 2, and 3 prepares us to get well, foundation. 4, 5, 6, and 7 gets us well. 4 to 9 get us well. So here in the 4, I'm beginning to identify the stuff that really needs changing. In 6 and 7, I'm going to get rid of it. In 4 and 5, I identify it. So I began to look at some of the stuff. At the top of the list for me was controlling. By controlling, I'm talking about self-centeredness of the big book. It's a just different word, but it's exactly the same thing. I'm talking about imposing expectations. In my case, it was not that I was running around telling people what to do, but in my head, I was creating scenarios and stories all the time of how you should act and what you should do and how you should respond, what they should do in the supermarket, what the president should do, what everybody should do. In other words, I was imposing in my head shoulds and oughts on the world. Mental master plan. That's what was going on in my head. Well, first of all, nobody knew what the master plan was. And even if you knew what it was you were supposed to do, you weren't going to do it. So I was doing nothing but setting myself up to always be in frustration, because nothing was going to go that way. So it was an example of really stupid, bad thinking, just spinning all these scenarios in my head, making movies in my head all the time, imposing irrational expectations on others. Anger and resentment, we'll talk more about these tomorrow in 4. Self-pity, blaming everybody, not taking responsibility for myself, judging, negativity. Just a few of my examples that I came to see of really bad thinking that came from my childhood. I call these my bullshit paradigms. My worth is dependent on what others think of me. Now, this is where you're supposed to say bullshit. It's true. My worth is not dependent upon what others think of me. That's what my mother said. Remember, what will they think? Well, someplace in that program, way deep in my head, was that my value was based upon what I thought you thought of me. And in fact, it's bullshit, because my value is based upon what I think of me, not what you think of me. I need everyone's approval to be okay. Not true. I don't need everyone. It's the old 99 people say I'm okay, one says I'm not okay. Guess which one I focus on. Right. Self-sufficiency is a virtue. Asking for help is weakness. I told you about that. That's the childhood that I came from. Never ask anybody for help, particularly if you're a man. It's weak. My father said that over and over and over. We don't ask for help. You do it yourself. expect the worst from people and never be disappointed. And my mother still says that, but not since last week. I am a prisoner of my past. It was a biggie. It sounds so simple. We don't think we're prisoners of our past. But man, you know, we make ourselves prisoners of our past. We have a choice. We can break out. We can break out. It's like fear. Fear is a conditioned response. It means it's learned. What that means is, if you learn fear, you can unlearn fear. If you've never heard that, pay attention. If fear still dominates your life, you can unlearn it. It's very possible. It's not just trust God. There's a lot more to it than that. You can unlearn it. So those are some of the examples. My pain is caused by other people, right? Or circumstances? No. Achievement equals self-esteem. If I truly surrender to God, God will take care of everything. All right, in the interest of time. So I went through the steps that first time, 1982. I started my amends, did my amends probably about month 9. And had pretty good abstinence, had a very good abstinence for long periods of time. And then I would go off for maybe 3 or 4 days and then get back on. Now, my abstinence at that time is really basically still what it is today, except for the flour. It was 3 meals a day, nothing in between, no planned meals. I weighed and measured most things in those days. No sugar, refined carbs, and that covers a lot of stuff. And I was eating only, that included white flour. White flour was very clear, was almost like, not quite as bad, not quite as toxic. By the way, I like to do toxic food charts, because they are different for different people. You know, for me, the donuts are up here. Some other people, the donuts might be down here. It depends on how your body reacts. So some things were not as toxic for me. So the white flour wasn't as toxic as the sugars. So in those days, that was my abstinence. Today, it's sugar and flour, sugar and refined carbohydrates, any kind of flour, even if it's whole wheat. But I ate whole wheat flour for many years. Then I moved to New Hampshire in 2000. When in Rome. Nobody ate any kind of flour there, so okay, why not? So I've been off of the flour since 2000. But now I don't live in New Hampshire anyway, and I'm still off of it, so okay, whatever works. So anyway, I would go through periods, and then I would get it back. So I count my abstinence. I remember my abstinence the last thing I had. If I would have known that it was going to be the last one, I would have not did it. I remember it clearly. It was a stupid cheese Danish. Clearly. At the Texaco filling station. On the corner of, on the way to work. I ate breakfast, and then I would stop there and get some more stuff to eat on the road. I remember the last one. It was June 1st, 1984. That was it. So I count that as my abstinence, my particular abstinence. So fast forward on a story. My life began to change greatly as the transformation process of the steps took off. My career took off. I'd basically been a political type person in my company. So I was always on stage, always play acting, blah, 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 never telling people what I really thought. So this program was all about integrity. Step 5 particularly is about integrity. So I decided I needed to be honest and be who I was. And so I started standing up and being who I was. And guess what? It was met with, oh, okay. And I found out that honesty, more often than not, honesty begets honesty. So my career began to really blossom. I was able to reinvent my job, almost invent a totally new job. And for about 12 or so years before I retired, I worked in the most exciting, edge of the envelope stuff for me. Just creativity all the time. Traveling the world, working on management change. 37 countries. Running around talking to top management about cultural change, doing this and doing this. So it was a job that I invented, and they paid me a lot of money to do, and I loved it. So I was always working at my edge. So, and that's all because of the program. In my marriage, that marriage that I had spent so much time in, I tried to put that marriage back together, tried to do my part, follow chapter 7 of the big book, did everything that I was told to do in chapter 7 of the big book, even went to the meetings, chapter 7 meetings, we had some in our area, but it takes two. And she was not willing to forgive. I had a lot of transgressions, and again, through the course of the weekend, you'll hear some more about that stuff as we go through the steps. But she was not willing to forgive, really angry. And so eventually, after five years from beginning a program, I divorced her. And 2 years later, I ran into a woman in an OA meeting in Paris, France, where I was traveling. And it was one of those things, you know. So she's the one who's celebrating 25 years tomorrow. So we've been together for 20 years now, something like that. An OA couple. Many other things in my life changed and improved. I redeveloped relationships with my two children because of the ninth step, and you'll hear more about that tomorrow night. That reopened those relationships because I had not been a good father. But guess what? I'm a really good grandfather. I'm a really good grandpa. And that's one of the reasons we're moving back to New York, is to be closer to the grandkids. I live in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania now, so shortly we are moving back as soon as we find a place to live. So be closer to the grandkids, because I am a good grandpa, and they love me. I was a shitty father, but I am a good grandpa. I've stayed in the program, worked the program, never really been in relapse since 84. And we'll talk more about that tomorrow, you know, why that I think that is. It's just continuing to work the program. Now, I've had all the challenges that anybody who's 70 years old is going to have had in their life. You know, been through the death of my father, which my father basically took care of my mother. My mother is, you know, as I said, mentally deficient, full of fear. My father just basically did everything. I was an only child. He died in 97. Since that time, I have been basically responsible for her. She lives 250 miles away. Now she's going to live 500 miles away. But so it was a long distance caregiving. But she's been very independent. You know, I just had to take care of the financial stuff and make sure stuff got done at the house and so forth. But she was pretty independent. And then last July, she, at 91, fell and broke her hip. And that was it. No more dependence, no more independence. So I had to force her into an assisted living facility, had to sell her house to get the money to do that, et cetera, et cetera. So the last 10 months with my mother have been, I guess, the most difficult period of my life. And you'll hear more about that. So what's the point of all this? Point of all this program is work through all of this, right? So death. Disease, divorce, I went through the divorce, abstinent. Disease, my own, I have spinal stenosis and degenerative spine disease and skin cancer. I've been battling skin cancer since 85. You know, if you look closely, you'll see the little white spots all over me. If you look closely, you'll notice that the top of this ear is not there anymore, right? That's been cut off. So I have lots of the skin cancer stuff that I've been battling. Spinal stenosis is an interesting story. In 2001, I was told, 2001, I could not stand on my feet more than 5 minutes. And then I would collapse. The bottom of my body would go dead. It was like a knife in the ankle. That's spinal stenosis. I could stop the pain by sitting down, but I could not stand up. Literally 5 minutes. So that just destroyed, you know, your life. I was told by the doctors, unless you have your total back rebuilt. By the way, you know, when you carry around 300, 400 pounds for many years, you break it down. That's what I did. So I was told by the doctors, unless you have your back rebuilt, we want to put in 3 new vertebrae, put in these steel rods, do the whole thing. Unless you do that, you'll be in a wheelchair for the rest of your life. Guess what?
I didn't do it.
And I'm standing up more than 5 minutes now, right?
Yeah.
I went through a whole series of doctors until I finally ended up at Harvard Medical School. And doctors there took a whole different approach to this idea. Their approach was about exercise and moving the nerves just a little bit off the bones through exercise. So I went through an 8-week basic training course up there on exercise. They gave me shots, they gave me epidurals and facet blockers, they call them, you know, big needles in the back to numb it so that I could physically do the exercise. Went through that for about 8 weeks. Learned how to exercise. That was 2002. I still exercise 3 times a week, and that's the way I manage the pain. No drugs. I don't do drugs. I read Dr. Alcoholic Addict, and he said no chemicals of any kind, and I'm still hooked on that. So I don't do any of those kind of drugs. I've never done that. So no drugs, and I manage this stuff with exercise. So I exercised this morning before coming down here, and I'll be back in the gym on Monday. And it's just what I do. So I've learned how to do that. What's the point of all this? The point is, I have a life stuff like everybody else, and the program has taught me how to live life, to deal with life, abstinently. Because, you know, without abstinence, life is chaos. In my brain, it's chaos if I'm not abstinent. It just is. Abstinence is what clears it up. You know, it's the food that drugged me to try to keep me from dealing with reality. So the program has taught me how to deal with reality. So the program has worked for me. Let me just close with two things. I'm going to give you a short version of the steps, the whole process, and then give you what I'd like you to think about, write about tonight. And then we'll reconvene at 9 o'clock in the morning. My short version of the steps. And you'll hear these or something like this again at 12 o'clock or close to 12 o'clock Sunday. But just want to tell you the short version, the process from 10,000 feet as I see it. One, admit and accept that I'm beaten, that I want to stop and can't. Using my willpower and a sponsor's help and the strength of the room, stop overeating. I've done it before. To get over overeating, I have to stop overeating. To get over overeating, I have to stop overeating. It doesn't just seep in. I have to do something. I have to go to the store. I have to make the plan. I have to buy the stuff. I have to, et cetera, et cetera. I have to stop. 2, the gathering of hope. If they can do it, maybe I can. 3, surrender completely to a whole new set of ideas. 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 9 tools, slogans, the fellowship itself. Sign up for the course. Decide to cooperate. I've always said that surrender is not giving up, it's deciding to cooperate. Surrender is not giving up, it's deciding to cooperate with a set of rules that I didn't invent. That's the 12 steps. I didn't invent them. So put aside my ideas and adopt a new set of ideas. Admit yourself to the OA hospital and say, okay, what do I do? 4 and 5, start the action I signed up to do in 3. Identify the faults, the real problems between my ears, the causes and conditions, the dysfunctional ideas, beliefs, values, etc. 6 and 7, let go of the faults, the bad thinking, the dysfunctional ideas. More importantly, start practicing the new thinking and the behaving. Like, for example, one day at a time, easy does it, first things first, live and let live, let go and let God. 8 and 9, stand up tall. Remember, you got the steps up here. If you don't know, if you haven't done them by memory. By the way, you can't live the steps if you don't know them by memory. So that's, as somebody in this room will know, if you're going to do the steps with me, you have to memorize them. 8 and 9, stand up tall, hold my head high, take full responsibility for what I've done. Say I'm sorry, I'm not going to do it again. Then don't do it again. A thorough 9th step allows me to let go of yesterday and live in today. That's what 8 and 9 are about, cleaning up. Letting go, getting rid of the baggage. Let's move on. Get in today. Stand up tall and move forward. Take full responsibility. 10, remember 1, 2, and 3 prepare me. 4 through 9 get me well. Remember in the big book, the obsession is lifted after 9. That's where the promises are. right? Steps 9 and 10 is where you'll see two sets of promises. After step 9, you'll see the spiritual promises. After the little paragraph on step 10, you'll see physical promises, if you want, that talk about the lifting of the obsession. So, in 10, 11, and 12, keep doing all the things that got me here. Take my spiritual temperature. That's what I believe step 10 is. Keep taking my spiritual temperature every day. See what's going on. Keep things clean as I go. 11, this is my short 11. Find God, listen to what He has to say, then do it. Find God, listen to what He has to say, then do it. 12, live according to these principles. Tell those who want to hear it how I got my freedom. Give them hope. Willingness is up to them. I can't make any of you willing. I can share my stuff. Whether or not you're starting, whether or not you just want to kick your program into a higher gear, whether you want to just restart, whatever it is, it's all about willingness. You have to believe that it works, and then you have to be willing to take the action. All right. So that's it, except I want to give you something to think about for the night. What did I do with that question? I have a choice of about 10 different questions here. The one I think I want to do I know which one it is without finding it. This is what I want you to think about and write on. If God is the whole answer, why isn't this a three-step program? If God is the whole answer, why isn't this a three-step program? Questions? I like to cause a little trouble here and there. You know. All right. We reconvene here at 9 o'clock promptly. And then we'll be breaking into groups for discussion tomorrow. And it's imperative that you get back from those breakout groups on time. I'll give you times as we go. We have no firm schedules. We'll set the schedule as we go along, depending upon the time and so forth. And I guess that's it. By the way, there will be an incentive for you to get back on time. And the incentive... That's my idea of a balanced diet, a cookie in each hand. There'll be an incentive, and the incentive is really, really bad humor. I'm going to do humor at the end, at the beginning of each session after the break. I have some of the worst, god-awful jokes that you have ever heard. They are so bad that you're going to hysterically laugh at them. He's serious. I like puns, and I've got 1,000 puns. So come on time, and you'll hear the silliness. Okay, you got anything, Maria? Okay, thank you all.
You want to do one more?